Sam, you are listening to the Velo News Podcast for the week of February 27th. I'm Fred Dreyer, editor-in-chief of Velo News, and racing is back. Racing has been back for a while, but Cobblestone, Hardman, Belgian racing is back.
Legit racing.
Legit exciting racing. As always, I'm joined by Kaylee Fritz and Spencer Paulison.
Hey, Fred.
Kaylee, do you have any good stories of watching the races this weekend?
No. I finally broke down and just bought Eurosport. I had to VPN in, but it was worth it.
God, you're so fancy. I was doing the Eurosport English feed as well as the Belgian Sportza feed, which was 25 seconds ahead. So there I was just getting viruses on my computer and watching advertisements for online betting sites. But it was worth it. I had a good time. Spencer, how about you? Do you watch the action?
I did. And it's always really exciting when we start to see the Cobbles riders come out, the Classics riders. This is a fun weekend, and we had great racing action both days, which is what makes it even better.
So let's get into it. We have takes. We have opinions on what went down. Let's get into it. Garbage, strong takes, bad takes, all the way around. Saturday, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, group of three, Greg Van Avermaet, Peter Sagan, Sepp Van Mark comes into the finish, and Greg Van Avermaet is able to win the sprint, second year in a row. Let's get into it. Let's talk about Sepp Van Mark first. After the race, he was in an interview with Peter Sagan, and Peter Sagan asked him a question I think we'd all like to ask Sepp Van Mark.
Why you didn't attack? You have to attack. I don't go for you.
Great question.
Good question.
Very good question. By the way, if you have the time, go find that interview. We have it on one of our stories on velonews.com. Andrew Hood's story about how Peter Sagan won a bunch of Oscars this past weekend. It's just silly. He's sitting on the Sporza set, playing around with the adjustable height chair and putting his chin on the desk.
Genuinely not taking it seriously.
Yeah, he's like, it's great, a bunch of Belgian guys, criticizing me for getting second place.
Well, yeah, and then he ambushed Sepp with that question, and then Sepp kind of just went straight into Flemish. Sepp just kind of ignored it.
Sepp Van Mark said, oh, well, we're waiting for the sprint. And to me, that is just probably the worst idea possible.
Yes.
I think it's great that he made the move and got into the final three. That's what you need to do. He's been riding really well this race. The thing is, I just can't imagine any scenario when he would outsprint two-time world champion Peter Sagan or Olympic champion Greg Van Avermaet. Sepp Van Mark is a great, great rider. He can sprint pretty well, but he's not going to outsprint those two guys. What do you have to lose by attacking in the last 2 kilometers, give or take? Give it a shot. At the worst case scenario, you're rolling in by yourself to third place. But if you think about it, you got those two guys. If you attack them, they could just look at each other and be unwilling to pull the other back to the front of the group. And maybe that's all it takes. But he might have just run out of matches to burn.
Yeah, I think his only hope there really, maybe he was thinking back to, Sepp won Omloop in 2012, if you recall. He did so over top of Tom Boonen, who is theoretically a better sprinter than he is. Maybe he was thinking back to that and just hoping that he had better legs. But really, I think if he's honest with himself, he knows he's not going to win that sprint. He should have probably gone for it. The real question is just why didn't he? Was he thinking that there was some sort of gentleman's agreement that he had agreed to and then was maybe regretting? I don't really know. He should have gone for it.
I think he did go for it, but he went for it so hard on the Molenberg, which is what ended up making the final selection, that he's just out of bullets. I mean, he nuked it up the Molenberg. His attack dropped Griefko, dropped Gugiard, thinned that group down to just the final three. I was really impressed. That definitely bodes well for his form heading into Flanders and Roubaix. But I just think that, once you put in an effort like that, you're kind of holding on.
Well, so Flanders and Roubaix is a good reminder that maybe he was just avoiding the Omloop witch's curse.
Ooh,
remember, no
scary
rider in the history of the sport has won Omloop and Flanders in the same year. Maybe he just really wants to win Tour of Flanders this year.
Huh.
Could be.
Yeah. I think that actually, that's a good segue into the next guy I want to talk about.
Is that why Peter Sagan? Yeah.
No, Peter Sagan.
Yeah. Okay.
To me, guys, Peter Sagan looked like he was on a training ride. He looked like, you've ever been on a group ride when a pro cyclist shows up and they're so much stronger than everyone else that they can just take huge pulls and drift off the back and just burn matches left and right and not really care about it. To me, that's what Peter Sagan was doing. So he was taking the longest pulls in the group. He was like yelling and screaming at people and trying to get them organized. At times he would drift off the back. I mean, one time he rode into the grass, lost contact with the group, and then just casually rode up to it, no problem. He was skidding through turns. I mean, he looked like he was having like a lot of fun in that race.
I was having a lot of fun watching it.
And so it didn't really surprise me when they came to the finale and he just didn't have the kick, because I feel like he was spending a lot more effort than Van Avermaet, who was very cool and calculated, only took poles when he needed to, was always, you know, getting the draft. So I feel like Peter Sagan, maybe he's the strongest guy in the race, but again, he's cognizant of that curse.
Which is curse.
I'll also say that in that finale, I think Peter Sagan just chose the wrong guy to shut the door on in that sprint. Van Mark came around his left side on the outside of the corner. I think he should have probably just let Van Mark go. That he kind of opened the door for Greg Van Avermaet on the inside there. And that's, you know, but I'm sure just a momentary lapse of judgment.
Or perhaps it was poo-poo problems.
Oh, yeah.
As we all know.
That's true.
In the interview scene around the interwebs, Sportza was doing some trolling of poor Peter Sagan after the race and asking him very pointed questions. Kind of like the beat reporters of an NBA team when like a visiting star is in town and he loses. Ask him questions like, so like you were pretty bad out there. What was up with that? And there was a question about Peter Sagan's health and his answer was,
I think it's normal for the people if they go on the toilet or not. No, it's no problem. It's okay.
And he's right. We all poop.
Yeah, we all
poop. Everybody. Moving on.
I think another team that we can be somewhat critical of in this race is Trek Segafredo, who had the numbers and had some really strong riders in Jasper Stuyven and Ed Toones and Feline. But they just didn't really put the tactics together when the action was going down. So Jasper Stuyven's attack on the Tyenberg is really what kicked off the finale of this race.
It's a great attack.
With about 50K to go, he goes ballistic, draws out a select group of, I don't know, 15 to 20. And to me, it seems like, okay, he's got Fabio Feline, he's got Edward Toones in this group. Trek Segafredo is ready to just, you know, throw some tactical punches into guys like Peter Sagan and Greg Van Avermaet, who didn't have the numbers. And then what happens like 15K later is they miss the move when that group of six rolls off.
I say they're the only team with more than one rider in the top 10 at the end, but they didn't get on the podium.
Jasper Stuyven went to Twitter afterwards and basically said, you know, attacked at the wrong moment. So I think he acknowledged that maybe he spent a little bit too much effort on the Tyenberg and was gassed. I mean, he was obviously strong.
Yeah, he was strong in Kern the next day as well.
I mean, that said, this is a team that is sort of trying to figure itself out after the departure of Fabian Cancellara. So maybe we give them a little bit of leeway. This was the first cobbled classic of the season. I mean, guys like Fabio Feline hadn't really done classics in a long time. And all of a sudden he gets called up and gets fourth at Omloop. So maybe they figure it out before for the next couple of races.
We'll give them a pass, but I think we got to throw Quickstep under the bus.
Yeah. Can't give Quickstep a pass.
Quickstep floors just really didn't have a good day at the Omloop. And part of that is because Tom Bonin got mixed up in a crash. I think it was about 60, 50K to go, give or take. Kind of a big crash, actually. It was ugly. I'm glad he's okay.
Disc brakes did not cut anybody.
Oh.
That we know
good
of.
Good to know. Good
that
to
we know.
Know
of.
Well, I saw that.
We'll have to do some more videos on that.
I saw that meme on the internet of like the semi-truck all wasted that said someone's disc brake did that.
I've had about 50 people tag me in that photo in the last couple of days.
Yeah, so maybe that was Tom Boonen's disc brake.
Yeah.
But Quickstep just didn't have a plan B, it seemed to me. Yeah, you know, obviously you're riding for Bonin in that race, but hey, like, what happens if he crashes?
Yeah, I mean, wow, what a change from when they had three riders in the top four, right?
Yeah, they have kind of a block. They have kind of a block on the Omloop. It seems like they find ways to lose Omloop, and just they're very creative about their ways they find to lose the Omloop.
I was going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Quickstep actively tries to not win Omloop.
Witch's curse.
There it is.
Witch's curse.
Got to beat the curse.
They're avoiding the witch's curse.
They just look at this race and say, this is not one for us.
Just show up, kiss some babies. Good to go. So similar to Quickstep, I think that the Bulls Dolmans team can also be criticized for not really living up to expectations in the women's Omloop race on Saturday. part of that, I think, is due to the crash that happened at the top of the Paterberg in that race. It sort of mixed things up at the front, and it gave Team Sunweb a little bit of an advantage. They sent Ellen Van Dijk up the road, and then Lucinda Brand took advantage of that. Nice to see Sunweb in the mix right now. It's a good sign for women's racing. I think this means there's going to be less of that kind of stranglehold that Bols Dolmans had on the Peloton last spring.
Yeah, Sunweb actually looked really good all weekend. So Omloop Van Het Hageland, it was the other women's race this weekend, and Sunweb put two riders in a late move. So that was Ellen Van Dijk and American Corinne Rivera into a very, very late move that actually might have held on if they had worked together a little bit longer. Anyway, it's good to see, like you said, it's good to see that team riding really strongly. It's good to see a lot of different teams riding well. Orica pulled together a great lead out on Sunday. I think that not having Bols win every single race all spring would be a really good thing for women's racing in general. So I like seeing more teams able to sort of break that stranglehold.
Yeah. What can you say about Corinne Rivera? She's riding really well right now. We got we have the Women's World Tour kicking off. Do you think she has a potential to be, you know, in the finale for Strade Bianche?
I think so. I mean, I would still first and foremost look to Megan Garnier, who's won that race before, who is a Bols Dolmans rider. But I think if we're looking to other Americans who could do something this weekend, then Corinne is definitely at the top of the list. I mean, to make the move that she made on Sunday, she's definitely in good form. She's a pretty good climber and a very good sprinter. So that tends to be a good mix for Strade Bianche in particular, which is sort of sits right in the middle of that sort of climber, classics rider type athlete. We could totally see her in the mix. I would not be surprised at all to see Corinne ride into the top 10 next weekend.
Moving on to Sunday, guys, we had a very exciting Kern Brussels Kern as well. This race historically tends to be the sprinters classic. This year the sprinters were all in Abu Dhabi, and it made for some really compelling dynamics. And again, we saw a really strong front group escape in the, you know, closing quarter of the race, and then it come down to this fun sprint, and Peter Sagan maybe fearing more bad sports questions if he lost, just decided to win. We might as well win.
He was just promised a handful of gummy bears if he won.
Yeah, that's true.
Which he did get.
What can we say about that finish line gummy bear gobble? I think I'm going to try to do that after all of my rides now.
Yeah, we should ask.
You don't already?
Not yet. Oh, God, it's a good idea.
So Trevor Connor and I are actually going to address this in a podcast sometime soon, whether you know, post-race nutrition via gummy bear is a good idea.
This is our Fast Talk training podcast, yes, by the way, just in case you're not. Check it out. It's a good podcast.
So I think the interesting angle here is the lack of sprinters. Kaylee, you wrote a really great column analyzing what happens when the sprinters are not at Kern Brussels Kern. What's your takeaway?
Well, basically the race gets better. That's my hot take, is that without the sprinters there, specifically without Cavendish there, who's won the race twice, Greipel, who's sort of a perennial favorite, and Elia Viviani. So that's three big teams. That's Dimension Data, Lotto Soudal, and Team Sky. Without those three sprinters there, the entire end of the race changes. So we basically had roughly the same things happen as usual, which is the last climb in Kern Brussels Kern comes about 50 kilometers from the finish. It's the Aude Quermont. It's a super nasty climb that almost always sends a group of classics favorites off the front. Generally, then, it's just sort of a cat and mouse where... cat and mouse is maybe not the right term. A Tom and Jerry, where the peloton is just chasing, trying to get this front group. And they usually get them, at least in the last sort of decade or so. They've gotten them more often than not. The difference this year was that without teams like Lotto chasing, without Sky chasing, without Dimension Data chasing, they never caught them. And it made for much more interesting racing because it gave that front group a little bit more breathing room and allowed a little bit more tactical riding up front there, including at the end, Peter Sagan taking a victory that I think bike fans are all pretty big fans of.
I'm going to disagree with you on that one, actually. I think, Kaylee, I'd say it's more exciting when you do have the sprinters teams in the mix, and it's more of a true sort of even battle between the two. At this point, I think Kern ends up becoming sort of similar to the other more prominent classics, but it has less prominent, interesting features like late cobbled hills and that sort of thing. I think that classics need to have some of this blended in and have a little more of that presence of sprinters teams to get a little bit of that dynamic of an opportunist team fighting with a sprinters team, and it can be a healthy thing, I think.
Well, okay, so Dylan Groenewegen was basically the first sprinter, and he finished only 13 seconds behind Beresagen. So it's not like it was a blowaway.
Actually, Arnaud Démare would be the first sprinter.
But Arnaud Démare was in the group that separated itself over the Ode Quermont. That is the difference. From the peloton, I mean.
Oh,
so if you're looking at the main peloton, essentially Dylan Groenewegen was the first guy across the line with the main peloton. 13 seconds is not a big gap, right? We still had the chase. We still had the front group versus the peloton dynamic. The difference was that because there were no sprinters teams there, they didn't catch the group with 7-8K to go like they normally would, and then just line up a big lead out train and we get a sprint and Mark Cavendish wins. That this time of year is not necessarily what I want to see. We get plenty of that during the Tour de France. We get plenty of that during all the Grand Tours. This time of year, I want to see as many little tiny groups battling out as possible.
You don't want to see the boy racer, Mark Cavendish.
I call it the 90s sitcom dynamic. It's the will they or won't they.
Ooh.
No, I love it too, especially in these early races, having a good will they or won't they storyline. So maybe what we could do, I got the answer right here. Sprinter quota. You know what? Just like you got to have a sprinter quota. All right, maybe 3 sprinters this year. Yeah, sorry, Cav. We reached our quota already. Got to go home.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I think that this may permanently change Kern-Brussels-Kern. That's the other interesting thing here, is that Abu Dhabi's a World Tour race. It's going to continue to attract big names. You know, is Kern now not a sprinter's classic anymore? Maybe.
We'll have to wait till see you next year.
Yeah.
When we fire up the live stream and just watch more. Speaking of which, we were going to be firing up the live stream this coming week and weekend because we have some races on tap. We have Les Samines and the Strade Bianche. Spencer, you'll be watching?
Yeah, definitely. Two really good races. Les Samines, I don't think any of us really know how to pronounce that, but
Les Samines. It's from the French part of Belgium, so
yes.
I would say French pronunciation. It's named after José Samin, who died in a race accident in 1969, just so you know.
Good trivia.
Yep.
It's a UCI 1.1 race, which means it's not quite as prominent as Kern and certainly not as prominent as Omloop, which is now a world tour. The thing is, it has a really exciting course. They have a short local circuit that finishes the race, and they have this kind of wild little cobblestone section just about 2.5 kilometers from the line, and it can kind of get pretty rowdy on that section. Guys are fighting for position. And I've seen some pretty exciting finishes to this race the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think it's an awesome, awesome course. So they move into Wallonia, which is the other side of Belgium, which normally we associate with the Ardennes and you know, hillier type races. And this race definitely has some hills in it. But the interesting thing is that it has these 16 sectors of cobblestones. And so you have this combination of hills and cobblestones. And then you also have a really, well, kind of strange start list compared to what we're used to, in that there are only 3 World Tour teams there. That would be Quickstep and both the Lottos, Lotto Soudal and Lotto NL Jumbo. And the rest of the field is all these Conti and Pro Conti teams, which means it's a whole lot of riders that we don't really know that much about. We're not used to seeing. We don't know who's good at what. And so it's very, very unpredictable. And I think that makes it a really cool race to watch. It does tend to get won by one of the World Tour guys, you know, won by Nicky Terpstra in 2016. But still, it's a fun one to watch.
I bet this one is great for like the weird name All-Stars. Mm. Funny name All-Stars.
My pick is Jesper Asselman.
Ooh.
On the Roompot team.
Is it kind of
reminds me of the Ass Man guy from Seinfeld.
Yeah, of course. We got tacos, we got Ass Man.
I don't think Taco's starting.
No.
I don't think Taco's starting.
The other thing about this race is that it's a midweek race, so you can be at your workplace and pretend like you're working.
Yeah, take the morning off.
And
just watch
actually just streaming bike racing, which is, you know, something that we don't usually get around to doing till May with the Giro.
There's also a women's race. Chantal Block won it the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's probably a pretty decent chance that she does so again.
Mm-hmm. Strade Bianche. Love this race.
This is a great race. And it's still so new, which is crazy, right? I mean, this race has only been around since 2007, but it feels like it's just got such a cool history.
We already think of it as a classic.
It is a classic. Yeah. It is a classic, legitimately.
What I like about this race is the different types of riders who can excel at this race.
Yes. Well, that's the most interesting thing about Strade Bianche. So women's race is 127K. Men's race is 175K. It's through the rolling hills and white roads, which is where the name comes from, of Tuscany in Italy.
Dirt roads.
White dirt roads.
Grode roads,
perhaps.
Any growth sacks?
And it finishes with this super, super nasty kick up to Siena, back up to the big square in Siena. And so, yeah, it's always kind of a mix between classics riders that are super on form. So classic riders that can climb a little bit.
Fabian Cancellara won it.
Exactly. Three times. Yeah. And and those guys are probably fitter this time of year than most of the GC guys who would normally be better climbers. But because there's so much climbing in it, the GC guys who are starting to build form for Paris-Nice and maybe even the Giro, those guys can definitely contend. It tends to get won by classics guys, but is often defined by GC guys. I think there's a bunch of riders we can keep an eye on this year. So first and foremost is Stibar, Zdeněk Stibar, who's been very, very consistent in this race over the last couple of years. He won it in 2015, second in 2016. I think he's, for me at least, the number one favorite. But you can also look to more sort of GC-type riders, climber-type riders. And at the top of that list for me would be Rigoberto Urán, who we hear has not been training so much for Grand Tours as one-day races this year. So maybe we see an Urán of the 2012 London Games, perhaps?
Sounds like a sandbag move. Sounds like a sandbag move.
Does that
lowering
mean
expectations.
That, does that mean that he'll be getting second place?
So who's your pick, Kaylee? Who's your pick?
My pick is Stibar. Okay, I think Stibar's going to do it, which is not a particularly exciting nor bold pick. My secondary pick would be Urán, and then
I only gave you one pick.
All right, two.
Only one.
I'll stick with two.
What about you, Fred?
Going to say Stibar, but I'm going to not pick him because I don't want to support Kaylee in his Stibar picking ways. Although, yes, some of the most exciting finishes have included Stibar either winning or just getting his head twisted off on that final climb to Siena. You know what? I'm going to go out. I'm going to go GC guy.
Okay.
Go full GC guy. I'm going Nibbles. Nibali.
Not Thibaut Pinot?
No. Sorry, Thibaut Pinot. You do not have the punch to win. Yeah, I'm going Nibali. He has never won this race. He has been in the final few moves a couple times. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's say this is the year he puts it together. Can you tell the like lack of confidence?
Yeah,
in the pick?
Wow. Yeah, strong take.
Strong
really
take.
Really good. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm going with Peter Sagan. Mm. Peter Sagan's riding really well, and he's never won the Strada Bianca, and he likes to get super rad on stuff like dirt roads and other kind of things like that. So should play to his hand, I think.
Do we know how the Italian press is towards Peter Sagan, like compared to Sporza? Because do you think they're going to ask some super trolly questions too? Like, Peter, you were no good, eh? Why?
No, I'm not sure what to expect there. We'd have to ask our man Gregor Braun on the ground.
You go to the bathroom? Why?
What about the women's race, guys? Who do we have to pick for the women's race?
Based on riding last weekend, I think Elisa Longo Borghini looks super, super strong. So at Omloop Van Het Hageland, which is hard for my brain to say.
Omloop 2.
Omloop 2.
Second Omloop.
Yeah, second Omloop. Sunday's on Omloop. She was part of that four-woman breakaway that included Van Dijk and Corinne Rivera and Chantal Black. And when they got caught, she hung out for like 10 seconds and then went again. So she's clearly one of the strongest riders in the field right now. She then almost made that second move stick. I think she's definitely one to keep an eye on. I also think that Bowles might have been taking it a little bit easy this past weekend, and we may see Bowles back in their sort of full strength this weekend. You know, Lizzie Dyna won it last year. Megan Garnier won the year before. They're two for two at the last 2 years. I really think it's hard to bet against that team once we get into these Women's World Tour races that mean a little bit more.
I'm gonna say Mariana Voss.
Oh,
she's on the list here. Had a great finish to her cross season. I think Mariana Voss is a good pick for this one.
Yeah.
I'll go Borghini. Yeah, she's a smart racer.
Were you going to say Voss? You made a face when I said that.
Yeah, I'll go Borghini.
I'm going Corinne Rivera. I'm going All-American.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
USA.
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 Exactly.
Bike racing's back, everybody.
I'm really excited.
How happy is everyone? I tweeted at some point this weekend just like, welcome back to my life, bike racing.
Yep.
I had missed you.
Off season's the worst. Yeah. We should just make them race all year. That's what we should do.
Oh, they would love that.
They would love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay. They're like robots. Kidding. I love you, pro cyclists.
It is February. There's no doubt many VeloNews podcast listeners out there who are riding long base miles on their bicycles this time of year. This is the time of year when we like to ride lots and lots and lots and lots and lots, which brings me to the topic of today's second segment, which is exercise addiction. When is too much riding too much for your life? I'm joined today by VeloNews managing editor Chris Case, who is also the author of the book Haywire Heart, in which you talk about how chronic exercise and how over-exercise can impact our hearts and cardiovascular systems. But we're going to be talking about a chapter that you wrote in this book about exercise addiction. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
So after reading this chapter, the first thing that struck me was defining what exercise addiction is. I think a lot of us think back to parts of our lives. We say, well, I was just worked out so much when I was 22, or I was a triathlete and I spent all of my free time and money doing triathlons. That was exercise addiction. It sounds like it's a little bit more complicated to actually diagnose someone as an exercise addict. What all goes into it?
Sure. So you're right. It is a little bit more complex than that. There's a brief, simple inventory that one can take that scientists have developed, and it's called the Exercise Addiction Inventory, and it basically breaks it down into six simple questions. You rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 5, and you add up those scores, and if you fall within a certain range, you are said to be meeting criteria for exercise addiction. That's the simple side of it. It gets a little bit more complex when you talk about the different components, and there's six of them, and we can go into a discussion of each of those briefly if you'd like. Obviously, the first one is that there has to be this prominence to the exercise of choice in your life. It has to be all-consuming. It has to be the most important thing to you in your life, and that salience or prominence is that sort of component. The next is mood modification. And to step back just for a second, you know, it's interesting because most of us think of exercise as being a good thing, and it is for sure a good thing. When you take it to an extreme level, it becomes something other than good. A lot of people exercise for positive reinforcement. They feel good about themselves. They stay healthy. They lose weight. They do it with friends. People that are addicted to exercise do it for negative reasons. So they're doing it because if they don't do it, they're going to feel guilty. They're going to feel anxious. Their moods are going to swing, those sorts of things. So that's negative reinforcement, and that feeds itself. So
that's something that I've heard time and time again in talking to friends of mine who are cyclists, and especially triathletes, is that topic of, well, I don't actually train because I want to feel good, but I just know that I'm going to feel like crap if I skip a session, even if I'm tired, even if I probably should take the day off. Right. And I always wonder myself, well, what, you know, why are you actually doing this thing? Is this, you know, is this adding value to your life right now?
Right. It's a good question. That component alone doesn't mean you're addicted to exercise, but it's a major component. Mm-hmm. So again, it has to be this all-consuming thing. It has to modify your mood in these ways. There's a tolerance component to it. So as people do exercise and more exercise, they gain a tolerance for it. It doesn't give them the same feedback that they initially got. So they build and build, whether that's duration, intensity, that sort of thing. And you see that in yourself, maybe in your past. I've seen it in myself where you just kind of want to do more and you want to go harder and you want to crush yourself. And maybe it's a stressful day and you go out there and you get relief from doing this. Well, a truly addicted person will do that, and then they'll go more, and then they'll go harder, and then they'll go more and harder, and it just builds on itself. So that's the third component. The fourth component is withdrawal symptoms. You know, if for some reason a person gets injured, a person with an addiction gets injured and they have to stop, they'll go through withdrawal symptoms. And we're talking severe withdrawal symptoms, severe anxiety, depression, that sort of thing. Not just a, I don't feel so good today. So there's that element. The fifth component is that this addiction, this behavioral addiction, has an effect on personal relationships, professional consequences, there's social consequences. So it really disrupts people's lives because they start letting exercise dictate their life rather than fitting it in around life, if that makes sense.
Didn't pay my taxes because I was too busy riding.
There's an excuse.
Didn't go to work because I had to put in some big miles.
At some companies, you could get away with that. Yeah. Not all of them, though. Not all of them.
Didn't go on a date last week because, got a big training session coming
up. Yeah, well, that happens in Boulder probably more often than it should. And then the last component is relapse. Again, if for some reason a person has to take some time off, whether it's due to injury or maybe they get treatment, then they come back after treatment, or they come back from injury, and then they go right back to doing what they were doing, this compulsive drive to exercise, that relapse component is part of meeting criteria. So those are the six components.
So you did a ton of research and lots of reporting around for this book. I'm curious if you have any anecdotes that you came across of people who were working through exercise addiction, or who were definitely suffering from exercise addiction, and the negative impacts that ended up having on their lives.
You know, I didn't actually speak with someone that was that met criteria for this clinical type of addiction. But, and again, this kind of goes back to your initial anecdote about, you know, when you were in your mid-20s, you felt like you were addicted. And there are times when a lot of people out there listening probably said to themselves, man, that sounds like me. I do it to avoid this, that sort of thing. Every person in the haywire heart that I spoke with that had developed an arrhythmia, at least in the vernacular sense of the word, said, man, yeah, I was totally addicted to exercise at one point in my life. Now, that being said, because the focus of the book was more on people with arrhythmias than it was on people with exercise addiction, I didn't end up speaking with somebody with an addiction. But there are definitely statistics out there. The general population of a Hungarian study, of all things, was that 0.5% of the general population might develop, has an exercise, meets criteria for exercise addiction. You start drilling down into different populations within that general group of people. And like, for example, students are 13% of students will have an exercise addiction. You start looking into athletes, and it's even more striking. A 2014 study of triathletes, male and female, there were a couple thousand in this study, 20% met criteria for exercise addiction. And that was, in fact, low compared to previous studies of triathletes, which had found up to 43% of these triathletes. And again, this was thousands of athletes in a study were meeting criteria for exercise addiction.
I think the takeaway here for some cyclists, and you mentioned, some cyclists will be able to look back at their lives and say, oh, yeah, I think that may have been the time in which I was addicted to exercise, is for us to look at the phase of our life when cycling started to really become a part of our lives. Because I know from my story and in talking to a lot of my friends, that is the phase in which cycling goes from, you know, the thing that you kind of like to do, or, you know, you do as a pastime. Maybe it's when you get into racing, or the first few years you get into racing, when you start to see, you know, positive feedback in your performance. Hey, the more I'm putting into this, the more I'm getting out. My body's reacting really well. I think that's a phase in which people can become really susceptible to overtraining and to some of this exercise addiction, because, you know, it's something you've picked up. Maybe you're good at it. You're seeing, you're seeing yourself get better with the more work you put in. And maybe you're in your, I saw this with myself when I was in sort of my early 20s. And it's like all the other parts of my life started to fall away in terms of importance. Riding my bike ended up being the most fun and most rewarding. Every time I, no matter what was going on in my life, I knew that if I could get on a bike ride, I was going to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that if I put more miles into my body, I was going to see positive reinforcement there. Mm-hmm. I was going to get faster.
Right.
And I just remember back in that phase of my life being like, you know, I have cycling and it makes sense. And I don't really, really need anything else. And I think that's something that a lot of people end up seeing in, like I said, that phase when they first pick up racing and they're starting to get faster. And maybe they're in their 30s or maybe in their 40s. And you see, you know, habits start to form and people start to spend a lot of time and a lot of money and effort on the bicycle. And I think that's something that, you know, our listeners can be cognizant of.
Yeah, is for sure.
This is maybe the phase in which exercise addiction can start to show, to show itself.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that there's a major difference between commitment and being super committed to getting better, getting faster, a specific event, and crossing the line into being compulsive. Mm-hmm. You know, when good becomes bad, it's a fine line that I think a lot of people walk because, as you said. It's a generalization to say cycling is kind of something that easy to become obsessed with, but you know, I think we'd both agree that that's a true statement. Like you see the progress. It comes. It's a time consuming endeavor. You put a lot of miles into it. You get a lot of positive feedback back. But then, you know, if there's a stressful event in your life and you then start using cycling to cope with that, that's when you start transitioning into using it as a tool to avoid negative feelings. And that's when it can become an addiction.
You know, a few years ago, I wrote a story about David Anthony, who was the New York City Masters racer who was busted for using EPO. And he talked about his story and his relationship with cycling and bicycle racing. And it definitely had elements of it, which was basically he picked up cycling in his late 30s, early 40s. He got to be very good at it. He saw immediate improvement in performance. It became his social circle, and he felt like he rose to, you know, kind of the top of his social circle because he was good at cycling. He started spending all this money on it, all this time on it. And then, you know, he admitted to having somewhat of an addicted personality or a very type A personality, and he was willing to like push it into kind of ridiculous levels, which was, you know, first of all, like buying an altitude tent, but then starting to spend thousands of dollars on doping products. Right. Like, you know, not just training and not just gear, but like doping products.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think that everyone who's addicted to exercise or who maybe has a somewhat unhealthy relationship with cycling is going to push it that far. But like he represents in my mind the extreme example of where exercise addiction can take someone.
Right. It'd be interesting to give him that survey and see if he met criteria. You know, I think, like I said, all the people that I interviewed for the case studies in the book that had arrhythmias claimed that they were addicted to exercise, but that was without, you know, going through the survey to see if they met criteria. But maybe this is an interesting anecdote. We paired that chapter on exercise addiction with the case study on Dave Scott.
Yep.
And I think that's a classic example of someone who is willing to admit he has an addiction and can't shake it and has for much of his life. And again, we don't know that he meets criteria, but I think it's fair to say that he probably does. And
he's a 6-time Ironman champion, Dave Scott.
Right.
He was my swim coach for a while. He's a good guy.
And, you know, he into his 60s now regularly is going to the pool in Boulder and trying his damnedest to beat the 20-year-old in the lane next to him in swim practice and then going out for a run and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. Can't give it up.
You got some interesting perspective and anecdotes from Dave Scott about sort of the emotional consumption of exercise and how, you know, maintaining this spot within the community kind of helps push him. Like what's pushing him? Why is he doing this?
Yeah, you know, he is this guy that is a six-time Ironman champion. People put him on this pedestal, and he is supposed to be almost immortal, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he's got to live up to people's expectations, or he has in the past had to live up to those expectations. And I think that's a really hard place for someone to be, an individual to represent fitness to the world, basically. And, you know, he regularly spoke about, when we spoke for the book, about times when he was completely depressed. And if he was an all or nothing kind of guy, and this is in the era of more being better, more and more and more of the volume wars between him and Mark Allen and things like that. And, you know, if he couldn't go out and do his prescribed run for that day at a pace that he wanted to do, if he just wasn't feeling it that day, he'd fall into a depression and he just wouldn't do it. He'd feel crappy about himself. He'd feel, you know, low self-esteem, all of that. And the next day he'd wake up, it'd be a different day. He might feel into it, and then he'd go out and he'd do it and he'd smash himself. But he rode this roller coaster day after day after day, year after year, I think, dealing with expectations and his own pressures that he put on himself, and these the negative feedback that he was receiving from skipping a session, and then that would just feed itself and feed itself. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex story. And this, like other behavioral addictions, whether it's gambling or sex or something like that, there's usually underlying psychological things going on. Now, I'm not saying that everybody that develops an exercise addiction is, you know, somehow a little bit crazy or off, but, you know, they're treating themselves in some way.
Yeah. Well, it's something that everyone should be aware of. I mean, we love our listeners here at the VeloNews podcast. We want them to be fast cyclists who spend time indulging in their sport, but we also want them to be people who spend time with their family and live fruitful lives and are happy, healthy people. And so I think that if anyone out there is interested more in exercise addiction and the impact that it can have on the body, then I think you should check out Chris Case's book. And Chris, the full title of this book?
The Haywire Heart, How Too Much Exercise Can Kill You and What You Can Do to Protect Your Heart.
And there's a lot more in this book about the impact that training can have, again, on your heart and cardiovascular system. And Chris spent the better part of a year alongside Dr. John Mandrola and Leonard Zinn researching this book. So everyone, go check it out.
Excellent. Thank you.
Guys, my favorite moment from this weekend was watching Peter Sagan stuff his face full of gummy bears after winning Kern Brussels Kern.
That was hilarious.
Got me thinking, though,
great.
For a question this week. Let's say you win a race. You're totally exhausted.
This is a real leap of faith for me.
Yep. Yeah, me too. What do you want to stuff in your face?
I'm going with a giant handful of cotton candy. You know, probably a similar effect to the Haribo gummy bears, but it would just dissolve faster. So it'd be much more efficient.
Just full-blown sugar
high?
Yeah,
like the size of my head. Just sort of like squinch it up and
it's good ride food. That'd be great good ride food. You're right. Cotton it does candy. Dissolve easy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually.
Get stuck in your teeth like you do, Fred, with the chews and, you know, the wisdom teeth holes and all that.
If there are any armchair like sports nutrition people listening today, think about it. Please, cotton candy.
Please tweet at us with your opinion of having cotton candy.
If you could like infuse it with electrolytes, that'd be the ultimate.
Protein cotton candy.
Oh.
Guys, you just came up with a brilliant idea.
Yeah. Nice. Screw this VeloNews thing. Yeah. I'm out of here.
Hey, watch for the Kickstarter, everyone. Yeah. Pledge to our Kickstarter and we'll make sure to keep your money.
What about you, Spencer?
You know those really cheap cupcakes that you can get at Safeway that come in like packages of like 6 or 12 and they're just disgustingly artificial colors and are pretty much synthesized in a test tube somewhere in a food lab? Be one of those. Those things, you just you eat one of those and it's straight to the bloodstream.
Oh, industrial cupcake.
It's so good.
The most processed food.
So good.
Industrial cupcake deliciousness. Well, as Spencer alluded to, I have giant pits in my mouth right now because I had my lower wisdom teeth taken out a week ago. And as thus, everything goes in there and it's uncomfortable and horrible.
Weight loss program.
And when I ate some shot blocks, they just got wedged in there. It was awful. So I will not be eating gummy bears anytime soon. So based on that, my dietary restrictions right now is basically yogurt. So I'd have Finish Line yogurt.
Or a milkshake.
Or a milkshake.
Go-gurt, dude.
Go-gurt, yeah. Except I'd have it just like sprayed at me with some industrial type hose.
I'm sure they still make go-gurt.
Yeah, just like bathing in a vat of yogurt.
Yep.
That's how I would finish my race.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Tubes of Go-Gurt in the back pocket. I think that's another
brand. If you could see my...
Go-Gurt and cotton candy, that's your nutrition plan.
Done.
Yeah.
Trevor will not be pleased.
No, he will not. Yeah. We would love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at webletters@competitorgroup.com. We'll also post links to the stories we talked about today on VeloNews.com. Subscribe to the VeloNews podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And while you are there, please leave us a comment and a rating. Very positive rating. Become a fan of VeloNews on Facebook at facebook.com/VeloNews Magazine and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/VeloNews. The VeloNews podcast is produced by VeloNews, which is owned by the Competitor Group. The thoughts and opinions expressed on the VeloNews podcast, especially those garbage takes, are of the individual. And as always, we leave you this week with the Brooklyn Boogaloo Blowout playing the Bernard Pretty Classic Soul Drums.